Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Ryan Kazantsian. He's the Chief Security Architect at Tanium. How are you, sir?
Doing great, thanks. Glad to be on.
Yeah, this is exciting for me because you not only are the Chief Security Architect at a security firm, but also for a time worked as a technical consultant alongside the writers of Mr. Robot. How long did you do that?
A little over 2 years. I joined during the pre-production phase of season two, a couple episodes in to the production efforts there, and then continued to work with the team through shots for a few different scenes in season two. And then when season three started, which was in pre-production work and writer's room sessions, I think we're in, late 2016, actually was much more involved from the inception stages of the storylines and how technology wove into them during the start of the planning phases for season three. Continued to work with the writers and production team all the way through the production of the shots we conceived and even helped out on set with some of the filming and scenes that we had thought through earlier on. So that lasted all the way until about mid-summer through 2017 when we wrapped up and stuff started to air.
Nice. I worked as a technical consultant on a movie very early on, and my job was primarily to go through the script, and I was told, make sure none of the technical stuff would make the writers look stupid. But it sounds like your involvement is much deeper than that simplistic work that I did.
So it's really a function of the show creators and especially Cor Adana, the writer and producer that I worked most closely with, really having that attention and care for detail. When I joined in partway through season two, a lot of the storylines and seeds had already been written. And so a lot of my role is what you kind of described there, where it was about executing the on-screen details to fit the scene and making a few tweaks and changes around the edges so that everything stayed accurate. But yeah, when season three rolled around, we really had a great time getting to sit back and think a little bit about how technology and some real-world hacks could actually fit and shape the direction of the narrative that the writers and show creator Sam Esmail were going for. And so that gave me a really cool opportunity to have a bit more insight and influence into the direction of the season.
Are you like me in that over the last 20 years of watching movies and TV, you've been disappointed in the quality of the tech?
Yeah, absolutely. And I say that as someone who grew up watching and chuckling at movies like Hackers, who depicted computer hacking and technology on screen in some ridiculous ways. And you had exceptions to the norm, right? Like, I also grew up watching War Games, which for all of the things that were kind of outlandish about the storyline, there were little bits and pieces of technology you'd see in it that were realistic and cool. So like, I remember seeing an acoustic coupler in that movie. And then I think in Sneakers, and that was the thing where before there were modems that plugged into the phone line, you'd literally put the handset on this device and it would play the modem tones through the receiver of the handset. And so, you know, those movies like kind of gave me a glimpse of that world and did at least a fairly good job of depicting parts of it accurately. Then you go to Hackers and movies like Scorpion, which just went completely in the opposite direction. And a lot of those movies in the 90s just captured hacking in a ridiculous way. And that unfortunately continued through to most of the movies and TV shows over the past decade or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the juxtaposition between the two kind of two people on one keyboard NCIS kind of style of hacking, which is painful, to the kind of the Minority Report, like trying to give you a sense of moving your hands and waving as being legitimate hacking, to the other side of the spectrum, which is real legitimate use of real hacks on on Mr. Robot, it makes me feel like the only thing preventing us from getting that level of narrative is just, for lack of a better word, organizational willpower. Someone enabled Cora, Donna, and folks at Mr. Robot to hire you and to do it for real.
Yeah, I think, you know, the prevailing assumption for so long had been that anything realistic in terms of depicting technology and computers, let alone hacking, in the entertaining medium was always going to be just intrinsically boring. Mm-hmm. And it's true that, like, no matter how realistic you make a scene, there needs to be something relatable that anyone watching can grasp onto and understand the motivations of the characters and why the scene's important, what's going on. And so you can't lose that. But I think Mr. Robot and the, you know, Sam and Core and the rest of the production team realized that by making it realistic, they didn't have to lose that. They still could make a incredibly compelling a relatable narrative. They can make scenes exciting, and they could layer it so that a non-technical viewer could watch and enjoy it and understand the outlines of what's going on. But if you were really technical, and if you were, for example, a security practitioner or one of our fans that likes to freeze frame and analyze every little bit of everything on screen, you had a lot more that you could even enjoy. And then that even goes a layer deeper with the alternate reality game that the show has. And so that sort of layered approach where no matter what your level of experience is, there's something you can get out of it. And the more technical you are, the kind of deeper appreciation you can get for some of it, I think is what made the show successful and inspired some of the fans that it's got.
I think that's a tall order, though, to say, well, like, for example, my wife is a nurse and she can't watch ER or The Good Doctor or any of these shows because it just causes her to roll her eyes back in her head so far that she can't even stand it. And I understand that like pilots that watch shows where there's an airplane being flown, they can't handle it as well. But you're saying that to be able to actually hold up to people who are screenshotting it and discussing it on Reddit, that's a tall order.
It is. And it's also a continuous source of stress for us. I mean, especially in season three, where I was a lot more involved in pretty much every on-screen depiction of hacking or use of a security or computing tool for shots, that the pressure as we were creating it was, is it going to stand up to that scrutiny? And, you know, we always have to make certain adaptations and take creative license to make things fit in the show. And so we really worked hard to minimize those wherever possible and make sure that we could hold up to that audience. Because in the end, that's the most critical group, but they're also the most passionate fans of the show and the most vocal in supporting it. And so getting it right for that group, even if it is a minority of the viewers, has always been really important. And it's been really tremendously gratifying to see how the security community, which is an incredibly critical group, I mean, by virtue of the work that we do in this industry, to get them behind it is something we're really proud of.
Yeah, and they seem to be generally pretty positive. It makes me think about the computer people, myself included, tend to be the most people ever. I could imagine that you might be afraid that you're going to put a great episode out there and then a Medium post tearing apart your work appears the next day.
Well, and the fun thing is, I had a series of Medium posts called Mr. Robot Disassembled this past season, where I kind of provided a behind the scenes of how Cora and I created all the hacks in each episode and what behind that. And sometimes some of the things that went on before and afterwards and the way we planned it or even designed it that didn't end up making its way onto screen. And for every time I'd post one of those, I'd get great comments and feedbacks and messages from people who were domain experts in the specific areas of security that we were highlighting and whatever that scene might be. And they're the ones who definitely noticed, well, why'd you do this instead of that? Or was this a mistake or intentional? And but it was always with a like positive sort of appreciation that, look, like, we get it. It's a TV show. Everything can't be done in real time. But getting that sort of feedback means people are paying attention and care. And that was really fun.
That's nice. One of the things that I've noticed is on TV shows in general is that people always seem to use IP addresses that are out of range. You know, as soon as an IP address is greater than 255, you go, oh, okay, well, that's just like, you know, when they dial a number and it's 555 something, 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 that's just their way of saying, hey, we're in a movie. But it seems like IP addresses in Mr. Robot all resolve to something.
Yeah, that was credit to CORE long before I got involved in realizing that there was a tremendous opportunity to not just do that for realism's sake, but to then start to build in this alternate reality game. Mm-hmm. And the way the ARG works is just about any IP address that you see on screen, phone numbers, email addresses, QR codes, all are sort of hidden glimpses at this story behind the story that you can follow online. If you go to an IP address, there might be a puzzle or a sort of emulated hacking challenge that's inspired by something from the episode. If you message one of the email addresses, you might get a response back. And that sort of puzzle world drives a tremendously passionate following of Mr. Robot ARG fans who spend lots of time on Discord and on Reddit talking about the puzzles, working their way through. And CORE has another separate team that he had worked with that really did a tremendous job of building out that side of the universe and making it a really interesting complement to what's on screen.
Mm. So how are the augmented reality game screens? Why couldn't you use those in the show? For example, I visited 192, 251, 68, 242, which is, it's got the Evil Corp background. It's got a whole shell. I mean, it's a very nice simulacrum of what happened on screen. And I can actually follow and type in what Elliot typed on the show. Could you use them at the same time? Like, could you use that for the game, for the show? Or did you have to mock those up differently?
So, and it depended. Some of the ARG sites are actually designed around the mockups that were made for scenes where the same sort of thing is apparent on in the episode. Mm-hmm. There are some steps in the ARG that go outside or beyond the scope of what you ever see in any of the episodes, and so those were done separately. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there were more than a few cases where the same things that were used to design what was shown on screen ended up being used there. Mm-hmm. The way it worked is, after writing out and designing the scenes, I would, in virtual machines, actually set up the software we were going to show to function almost as if it was an actual operator hands on keyboard. And so, for example, there's an episode where Elliot's using Volatility, which is a memory forensics tool, to look at some malware that's infected his laptop. And he's actually, when we created that, I was actually using Volatility with a memory image that I captured from a Linux system that was actually infected by me with the malware I was seeking to emulate. And so all of the screens that we put together for every single shot are produced like that. I try to mimic as much of it in a real system as possible. I take lots of screenshots, mm-hmm. a lot of copying and pasting so that the text can be provided to the design folks. And then CORE works with the animator that the show uses to turn that into what's actually a Flash animation, one of the mm-hmm. last places on Earth where Flash is still used. And the Flash animation is actually what gets played and in real time on set as the actors are interacting with their computers to pretend as if they're actually typing. So they're typing the keys and it's actually advancing an animation of what we designed and kind of pre-recorded.
Ah, that was my next question, how they sync up their keystroke. So it's like hackertyper.com where they hit the keystroke and it moves you forward one keystroke. So they really can't type them incorrectly.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's essentially allowing the actor not to have to worry about the hitting the right keys or even necessarily the precise timing of everything. It allows it to auto advance in a way. It also ends up looking a lot better. Like if you ever see something where they've green screened in a computer screen, it always looks a little mm-hmm. bit off, like the lighting and the style, whereas mm-hmm. actually filming the screen, displaying the contents looks a lot better. The flip side mm-hmm. of this is that means that when we do production, the shots have to be done before they film. And so I remember during production season, week after week, CORE would email me with the chunks of the script that we had worked on before and said, hey, remember when we had come up with this scene like 3 months ago? We're going to be filming these 10 blocks in the next week, so I need all of these ready a week in advance so the animators can create it. And so that sort of scheduling in blocks meant a really intense couple of months of putting those shots together in batches so that they'd be ready for when cameras rolled.
Wow. And you were doing all of this work with Mr. Robot independent of your day job at Tanium at the security firm.
Yeah, that's right. This was sort of my second night job. So I'm a night owl as it is. So after dinner, I'm almost always tending to some work, especially since I live on the East Coast. mm-hmm. in the DC area, but my company's based out in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So I'm up late as it is. And then on top of that, yeah, during production work, usually late at night, I'd start getting to working on that and then on weekends as well. But it's a lot of fun. It kind of scratched an itch that's very different than my day job. But at the same time, I look at it as complimentary because my day job has me doing a lot of work, thinking about defending against attackers and applying what I learned in my past life to building defenses and helping companies detect and respond to attacks. And working on the show kind of puts me back in the mindset of how I first got involved with security, which is thinking about how to break security controls and how to hack in. And so keeping that sort of offensive-sided mind of your brain working is really productive, I think, in security. You can't just be pure defense or pure offense. You need to have sort of balance. Working on the show gave me that yin and yang.
Well, and in the first episode of season three, even though your job at Tanium is your day job, you were able to work Tanium software into it because it was a natural opportunity for Elliot to put a firmware patch on a UPS.
Yeah, that it's actually in the second episode of season three. There's this opening montage of Elliot at work in Evil Corp, and ended up being really a really fun scene where in like the first 6 or so minutes of the episode, it's just really fast cutting, and there's about I think 4 or 5 different shots that we worked on, and one of them is a glimpse at Tanium, and it was a fun opportunity to actually take some of the software that I work with every day and. Have a role in helping create and design and actually inserting it into the show in a spot where it made sense, which is, yeah, as you said, deploying a patch to a bunch of Linux servers that were then managing uninterruptible power supply devices. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't an attempt to give Tanium a gratuitous plug. It was just natural fit.
Yeah.
But what I actually tried to do throughout the season and even in the prior season was also not just showcase Tanium, but also showcase like a lot of the great open source software that security researchers that I admire and respect and have followed for a long time build. So we have Mimikatz in there. We have Elasticsearch in there. We have Volatility Framework, as I mentioned earlier. It was really fun to just think about all the tools that I love using or have learned so much from and think about how to weave them into a show in a way that would both fit the story and also give the creators of those tools some deserved recognition for their work.
I remember when the people that worked on the tool for the Matrix saw Trinity in the Matrix using their tool, and there are a lot of, you know, the screenshots on Twitter of like, oh my God, this just happened. Did you give people a heads up in the open source community that you were going to do this? Or did you just wait for the tweets to happen the night after the show aired?
Generally, I gave folks a heads up. There are a few cases where I just, in the crazy schedule of things, forgot to do so. But yeah, I did give a few folks advance notice, like right before, to say, hey, you may want to watch tonight's episode and make sure to check out, you know, minute 34. You may see familiar. And yeah, that was a lot of fun.
That's awesome. One of the things that I think also makes the use of software a compelling piece of drama on Mr. Robot, more so than I think other shows that try to use computers in a dramatic sense, is the idea that Elliot is almost always interacting with hardware in some way, whether he's working on Linux machines that talk to UPSs or the early episodes when he's using Raspberry Pis. Is that because of any concerns you have around IoT, or just because there's such a proliferation of hardware that can change the world alongside the software that runs it?
So I'd say we've actually tried to just have a really wide variety of the types of hacks that Elliot and others perform in the show. And, you know, if we just did exclusively like enterprise OS Windows style hacks, that'd be really dull because they all end up looking kind of the same at a certain layer. And so weaving in some attacks that have kinetic potential, like the UPS stuff, some things that are IoT based, like the car hacks in season one, and even in season three, when we have some social engineering, like with the OnStar hack, where Irving calls up the emergency support number so that he can pretend that he's law enforcement and get a OnStar engine cut off to the vehicle that's chasing them. All of that is an attempt to introduce as much variety as possible into hacks. And it's another fun way that the need for a creative and exciting story pushes us. So that car hack I just mentioned, the OnStar one, came from in the writer's room, you know, a request to figure out a way to have an automotive hack that would allow Irving to lose their tail. And what we didn't want to do is a kind of Hollywood nonsense hack where, you know, just magically at that moment, he has the right tools to remotely hack and stop a car over the air, because that just simply does not exist in a way that would be believable. Mm-hmm. And so when you're posed with a challenge like that as writers and, you know, consultants for the show, we think about, okay, well, you know, how do we meet this in the middle and create something that's fun and exciting, but still has enough basis in reality? And that actually drives a lot of the variety. And I think some of the interesting and creative hacks that have made their way into the show.
Mm-hmm. One of the hacks that took me aback, like I had to pause and just think hard about that, was the one where the FBI is looking at Elliot's system. They're doing remote access. And, you know, a simpler, and this is try to give you a compliment, right? A simpler technical expert would have said, oh yeah, they're running, you know, VNC or RDP, or they're sending screenshots with PNGs of what's going on the screen. Can you maybe explain what you ended up doing on a bleeding edge hack to allow someone to see Elliot's machine remotely?
Yeah, so that was based on research called A Monitor Darkly, which was presented at Black Hat and DEF CON in 2015 or 2016, I think. Mm-hmm. And the basis of it basically involved finding that the display controller hardware that is present in millions and millions of monitors is vulnerable to a hardware layer attack, whereby basically implanting a device into the display port and USB interfaces, I believe, you could essentially manipulate the contents of the screen and or read the contents of pixels on the screen. We took a bit of creative license in adapting the ease with which that could be performed and the combined the hardware implant with like a small cellular enabled PC on a stick so that the images could be transmitted to a FBI receiver. But that was driven by one, the need to show something cool. But two, we also had a storyline reason where it needed to be a hardware implant, rather than a software implant. And so, we got to thinking, well, do we have a hidden camera in the room? That didn't work out. What about something in one of his devices? Keylogger? No, that wouldn't work. Well, what about in the monitor? That was kind of the thought process that led us down that path.
Mm. Have you ever bumped into a story requirement that where a hack simply didn't exist and you had to really make something fictional?
We've almost always found a way. the OnStar hack I mentioned earlier with stopping the car was one of those where at first read, we're like, "When? How are we going to make this work?" And then Cora and I went back and forth on a few different ideas with Sam Esmail, and eventually landed on Irving doing that social engineering call to OnStar, which I was worried about how it'll be received, but we actually found documentation on the protocol used in terms of making the phone call, talking with the emergency reps, the sequence of things that happens when you ask for ignition cutoff, the confirmation light, like blinking of the brake lights. And we replicated that all in the scene. And so we made it work, and it was well received. There were some others where likewise we made adaptations. The UPS hack that starts in season two and then continues on, of course, into season three was one with a firm basis in reality. There have been hardware hacks like that where the use of or the bypass of digital signature validation allowed for malicious firmware to be introduced into industrial control devices. There was a hack of the Ukrainian power grid a couple of years ago where that was one of the techniques used. There have been data center explosions caused by leaking batteries. One of the other consultants first provided that bit of inspiration when the UPS hack was introduced in season two. So there, like I said, there's always been ways to weave enough reality in to take an initial concept and run with it in a way that we all found acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Myself and the people who listen to the show here are largely, you know, application developers. And I think it's probably fair to say that security folks would feel that most application developers are blissfully ignorant of a lot of stuff. You know, we do our best to avoid SQL injection and kind of the basic stuff. But I always hear from the most paranoid security people, like, if you really knew what was going on out there, you'd never sleep. I'm curious, on a personal note, like, is that true? Is there, can you even walk through your house without feeling like you're looking for exploits in your fridge?
You know, I'm jaded at this point after being in the security industry as a practitioner for 14 or 15 years now. I just intrinsically assume that just about anything can or will be broken at some point. And I mean, you know, the headlines in the news week after week kind of bear that out. If it's not a retailer being hacked and losing millions of credit cards, it's a healthcare company being hacked and losing a ton of patient data, or it's an industrial control system being hacked because something was exposed to the internet in a way that it shouldn't have been. And so I think that general awareness is not just limited to security practitioners anymore, because enough of these make the headlines week after week. We're in an interesting place where there are, in some places, better security technologies than have ever existed. Often we'll say that the computer in your pocket, if you have an iOS device, for example, is many, many orders of magnitude more secure than any general computing device that we've previously engineered. And so we've clearly come a long way in learning how to build secure things. Mm-hmm. The problem is that while that may be the case, the rate at which other computing devices that don't have that degree of due diligence into their engineering and are thrown online at an incredible pace just vastly exceeds the pace with which we can continue to build and design and enforce good security practices. And so the scale at which that's happening is frankly terrifying, but will probably continue to inspire really entertaining fiction.
I hope so. I'm curious, though, without getting too much of the specifics or trying to pick on iPhones versus whoever, but is it because of smart people at Apple designed the iPhone to be more secure, or is it because of the walled garden that it lives within versus all the different Kickstarter things where someone decides to make a light bulb that runs a version of Linux and then puts the IoT device out there in the world and then goes out of business? You know, is this a matter of the architecture of the iPhone or a focused way of securing that Apple has applied to it?
Well, I think the architecture comes from that focus. And there's obviously a business focus also in having a walled garden. But I think both iOS and on the Google side, Chrome OS are examples of operating systems where security begins at the hardware layer, the center of trust that is isolated from the software and the underlying operating system. And that alone is a very different design decision than kind of the way general purpose computers and PCs that we grew up with work. And from that point, every time the system is opened up a little bit more to allow for applications to run, to allow those applications to share data with one another, to add extensions, they're all being added incrementally after a lot of scrutiny about how to make sure they still work with that underlying foundation of security that the operating system was initially designed for, the device was initially designed for. And so it's kind of the opposite approach of starting with something that's completely open and unrestricted and then trying to cordon off activity. That's kind of the ongoing struggle of enterprises now with your classic Windows and Linux PCs. And I mean, even we see that with OS X on the desktop, where taking an open operating system and then constraining and securing it is far more difficult than starting with something very closed off at the hardware layer even, and then adding incremental features to make it do more things.
And it seems like also even really, really closed systems like the Nintendo Switch, as an example, if they wanted to make the Nintendo Switch able to get onto a captive portal, onto hotel Wi-Fi, they needed a web browser. They put in WebKit, and the first exploits end up being that, exploiting that crack in the door.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad you brought that up. I'm also, in my limited spare time, a gamer, and I have and love my Nintendo Switch. I wish it had access to game saves in the cloud.
Yes, please.
The reason that it doesn't have game saves in the cloud is because of concerns over ease with which they can be used to load malicious code. And that's been a pathway for hacking gaming devices in the past. And so obviously Nintendo is trying to, I'm sure, engineer around that carefully. But, you know, the same thing goes with the iPhone, for example. I was a pretty early adopter of the iPhone. And I remember, you know, there was early days where it didn't have an app store, and everyone was kind of just amazed that they could even release a device without supporting apps. And sure enough, they incrementally added the feature when they were comfortable doing so in a way that was secure and, of course, conveniently also a way they could monetize really nicely. So the same thing I suspect will happen with the Switch and game saves. And, you know, again, when you incrementally add features after putting the engineering thought in, how do I do that securely, you just end up with a much different product than when you take the opposite tack.
Mm-hmm. I sure hope that they fix that soon, because I've got like 85 hours into Xenoblade, and I swear if I freaking lose that save, I'm going to be pretty sad.
Yeah, I don't know what I'd do if I lost my Breath of the Wild save after all those hours.
Yeah. So my last question is, how close is company reality? Like, if you look at the company that you work for, Tanium, is that company similar to the security and endpoint and systems management companies that you see in shows like Mr. Robot?
So it's interesting because, We joke at work that Evil Corp would be a great real world customer for the technology like Tanium, because we really specialize in doing security and operations at massive scale at environments that sometimes have hundreds of thousands of computers. The kind of flip side of that is in the entertainment world, and even in Mr. Robot, the sort of day-to-day functions of IT ops, like patching systems, is not really something that is terribly exciting. And so, you know, we have that glimpse of that in that one episode of Mr. Robot, but then most of where, you know, interest in television and media around computer security is in showing the hacking or showing people catching and detecting and stopping the hacking. We do plenty of that at Tanium, but from a software perspective, in other words, equipping companies to fish for themselves and detecting and responding to attacks. And so depicting that in a show is hard, because it's really like a internal operations and internal security function. The other company that I kind of analogize to my past life is Allsafe in the beginning of Mr. Robot. That's mm-hmm. where Elliot works. And that's a lot like my prior employer. I used to work at Mandiant, which is now part of a FireEye. And that's a consulting firm that does incident response work. And so having worked with a lot of other consulting firms, that sort of day-to-day job of having a fire alarm from a customer and having to respond to a breach and investigate is something that is really compelling to see on screen. I think Mr. Robot did a great job in season one of kind of capturing that little bit of industry. Yeah, I think, you know, again, the cool thing is, more and more people touch technology as part of their day jobs than ever before. And so just as you have, as you mentioned before, shows that highlight bits of the medical industry, like hospital dramas, and shows that illustrate bits of the legal industry, like the myriad of courtroom dramas, I think you're going to continue to see more and more shows that show bits of what it is to be a day in the life of people involved with technology in the corporate world. That's going to be true from a consulting perspective or internal, like IT ops and security.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much, Ryan Kazantsian, for chatting with me today. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you, Scott. It was great to talk to you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.